evening and welcome to KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. We are nearing Halloween, and Emmanuel Rogers recently spoke with a couple of authors whose books may be just right for the season, one of which is strikingly similar to the Salem witch trials in the United States. We'll hear from Begonia Echeverria, author of The Hammer of Witches, a historical novel set in a small Basque town filled with accusations of witchcraft. First, though, a conversation with Christopher Moore. He's the author of Secondhand Souls, that's set in San Francisco, where the souls of the dead are not being collected, but rather are mysteriously disappearing.
Secondhand Souls is your 15th novel. I'm going to ask you, what drew you to writing as a career?
Well, it was kind of the only thing I was good at. I tried a whole bunch of other stuff and failed fairly miserably at them, but I had always had a little bit of a talent for storytelling from the time I was about 12. So when I was in my mid-20s and had done a fair amount of failure up to that point, I had a girlfriend who said, you should maybe try that writing thing again. And I did, and I went to a writer's conference, and it turned out other people said I wasn't horrible at it either.
Well, that sounded like a great vote of confidence. But it seemed it worked out well for you.
Yeah, so far.
No, you use a lot of humor in your writings. Why do you think that people respond so well to the humor, even though it covers a lot of darker subjects?
Well, first, I don't think there's a lot of funny novelists out there, so I think they're just sort of surprised and relieved that there's something that, you know, they don't have to work that hard at. But I think that also the humor allows people to think about things that they put up their shields as soon as they hear about it. I found in writing these two books about death and dying, A Dirty Job and Secondhand Souls, that people responded by email saying, this helped me through a difficult time, which I wasn't arrogant enough to think that my little comedy was going to do that. But what it did was it opened doors to people thinking about things that they just kept closing doors. The comedy just acts as a doorway in.
Okay, great. You also use twists and turns of things supernatural. Why try to make death funny?
Well, again, to open the door to it, it was a challenge to me with the first one to say, can I write a comedy about death? But the way I say stuff is through comedy. I wasn't sure when I started the book if I was going to be able to do that, if I was going to be able to write a funny book about death. As it turned out, I could write two, at least so far.
Now, before we get to Secondhand Souls, I would like to ask you about some of your previous works. First, will you tell us about The Stupidest Angel and, in particular, Little Joshua, Santa and the Shovel, and the not-too-bright Angel Raziel?
Well, The Stupidest Angel is just sort of a Christmas story that takes place in a small town in Central California. And the way it all sort of takes off is there's a guy who's dressed up as Santa for the local, I don't know, men's club, the Moose or Elks or something like that. But, you know, not to imply that there's anything wrong with those guys, but this guy is a weasel. And he gets in a fight with his ex-wife because she's transplanting Christmas trees back into the wild. He attacks her, she fends him off, and ends up hitting him with a shovel. Well, this little boy sees this happen, and he thinks that a woman's killed Santa. So, you know, he makes a Christmas wish that Santa be brought back to life. And there's this not very bright angel who's given the job that year of granting one child's Christmas wish. So he comes down where the area where Santa is buried and sort of pronounces that everyone here should come back to life and doesn't realize that just on the other side of the trees is a cemetery. So the entire cemetery is brought back to life. And during the town Christmas party at the church, all the zombies crawl out of their graves and start to attack the church, you know, as one does at Christmas. So that was basically how that happened. But it all began with the Christmas wish of a little boy and having it granted by the not brightest halo in the whole bunch.
Now, I'm really curious as to where you got his name, Raziel, because I remember playing a little game that had an angel called Soul Reaver, whose name was Raziel.
Is that right?
Yeah, he didn't seem to be too bright either.
Well, you know, I thought I made it up. You know, you can find these old lists where medieval monks just tried to name all of the angels.
Right.
Really, only a couple are named in the Gospels. And I thought that I had taken it as a two or three different kinds of angels, but there may have been one on those lists named Raziel. I just really couldn't tell you why I picked it, and it's been 20 years since I wrote that book, I think. You know, I thought I made it up, but I certainly could have swiped it. I didn't do it out of Soul Reaper. It was out of one of those medieval lists of angel names.
Okay. Now, I have to ask you this for the parents in the audience. Are your stories good bedtime reading for the kids?
Oh, absolutely not. By the time your kids are old enough to read them at bedtime, then they should be reading them themselves. I have parents come to my events and they'll ask me, and, you know, maybe a really precocious 12-year-old, but only if you've read the book first. Even my Christmas book has a warning in it. It's, you know, there's going to be a lot of salty language and people in their 40s having sex, so just back off.
Now, you know, I was being a little facetious with that because I thought if parents actually read some of your books, they would actually think, no, I don't think I should read this to little Billy before bedtime. But you heard the warning.
Oh, there
here
are.
First.
They listen to the audiobooks in the car, and then they end up in these really awkward, I have to explain what that was about thing. And then they come to my events and they complain to me, and I'm like, dude, there was a warning on it. And they say, not in the audiobook. And I'm like, oh, well, we'll have to think that through then.
Christopher, your book, Lamb, it was funny and thoughtful, but I understand your parents would have had mixed feelings about it. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. I think that my mother was a Methodist from Georgia, and she just basically, as a Southerner, was embarrassed about anything you could be embarrassed about.
Okay.
But, you know, I had trepidations even when I wrote it. It's the humorous retelling of the Gospels from the point of view of Biff, who is Christ's childhood friend and has written out of the Bible because he's a rascal. Right. And I tell the 30 years of Christ's life that isn't told in the Gospels. It's not an attack book. It's not going after anybody's faith. It's sort of more or less accepts what the Gospels say as being the story, except it fills in all the blanks and how you get from A to B, you know, how you be, you know, get from being this little kid in Bethlehem to the man who saves the world. And I know even when I was writing it, my family was worried that I was going to end up having to check into the Salman Rushdie suite somewhere. And as it turned out, it was such a surprise how it was received. The people loved it. And I was getting notes at first from Unitarian ministers, but then Episcopal ministers, and Lutherans who were talking about citing it in their sermons. And,
wow.
And now it's, you know, being taught in at least a dozen seminaries around the country. And I think it's on the recommended reading list at Harvard Divinity. And trust me, they wouldn't let me mow the lawn at Harvard. So one of my books making it in is, I'm pretty happy with that. So basically, I think people got the story and it was a self-selecting audience. Those people that might be mad about it
right.
didn't read it, and they're not going to read it. And probably, you know, I had learned before I wrote the story what had happened to Kazantzakis' book, The Last Temptation of Christ. Mm-hmm. Nobody who read that book or saw that movie was mad about it. It was people who hadn't read it and heard what they thought it was, because The Last Temptation basically didn't happen.
Right.
You know, the whole, you know, Jesus marrying Magdalene and all that, it was the temptation. And it was just like anybody who was mad about it just was making a testament to their stupidity.
Yeah, you know, I have to confess, I'm a Christian. And as far as being mad about things like that, if I have a problem with it, leave it alone. You know, otherwise, go and read it with the intent that you had to make somebody laugh.
It's, well, exactly. And I think that that was why I didn't have any blowback on The Stupidest Angel. I think that it was the self-selecting audience. People stayed away from it. And it wasn't my intent. I mean, I hear from a lot of people of faith who have read the book and said that because it shows you the humanity of the character, it actually enriched their faith. You know, again, I'm not trying to take credit for that. I'm simply saying there's always a lot of evidence that people are dumber than we think they are. And I will point to sort of political trends in that direction. But it's not always the case. Sometimes people will surprise you with how much they do get it. And I was pleasantly surprised with the response from people.
Yeah, I guess it's a good thing not to confuse our thinking about politics with real life. Because, then our intelligence really shows. Donald Trump is running for president, by the way.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. What surprises me is that there are people who think that's a good idea. There's always a nuthouse Napoleon that thinks he should rule the world, but you don't usually get actually 40% of a party saying, yeah, and we think that's a good idea. So H.L. Mencken said no one ever went broke by underestimating the intelligence of the American public. When I've traveled for research for books and, you know, lived in other countries for months at a time, I mean, then you suddenly realize the whole world doesn't revolve around you. Just, you know, as a country, you just think it does. You know, there might be, you know, a tragedy that's hundreds of thousands of people are dying in sub-Saharan Africa, but, yeah. You know, what's going to lead the story is something that happened to some reality star, because that's how the news is fed to us in the U.S.
You know, now, before we get too far off here, your childhood friend, Biff, is he pretty gratified about knowing that he's in your book and that, wow, people now associate the name Biff with being Jewish?
Well, you know, the weird thing is, you obviously read in the afterword where I talk about that's why I named him Biff, is the first Jewish kid I knew when I was little was named Biff, and I thought it was a Jewish name. which it turns out it's not. But when I found out about this, and the book had been out for quite some time, I hadn't seen this guy. We weren't close. It was just the Jewish kid. I found out that he had passed away. So I've never been able to ever actually ask him. I didn't, you know, not to bum you out or anything, but I never got to ask Biff. And I really never knew him well enough as a grown-up to know if he had that kind of personality. I mean, I knew this kid when we were in fifth and sixth grade. But people who did know him said that he would have been happy to have been immortalized.
Now, in Secondhand Souls, we are informed early on in the story about missing souls. It struck me a lot because I wondered, how did anyone know the souls were missing?
Well, as often the case, everybody's first informed by this lunatic, the emperor, who's a character I based on a historical character, went broke, putting his fortune down on rice futures, and then went nuts and declared himself emperor of Northern California, protector of Mexico. And the difference between him and every other nuthouse Napoleon is the city of San Francisco went, oh, okay. So I have a character that's run through all my San Francisco books that's in the modern world based on this guy. And then in the first book, A Dirty Job, where we set up sort of the conceit of souls being transferred from one body to the next on their journey to the eternal by these guys that run secondhand stores, they start getting the names and not collecting them, and nothing happens. Whereas in the first book, when something happens, when they don't collect the soul, really dark things start to happen. So that's how they know the souls are missing. And also, the guy who paints the Golden Gate Bridge is starting to have the ghosts of the bridge come to him and say, hey, we need a little help over here. The book jumps around to different locations in the city that just gives you a pretty great idea that something is not going right.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about the bridge, but I don't want to give away too much of the story. So what is the significance of the bridge with the souls?
A couple of things going on. I'll talk to you a little bit about why I put the bridge in and then a little bit of how the bridge performs in the book. I've lived in San Francisco now for about 8 years, and the bridge is just this persistent piece of great art that you see all the time. And, of course, everybody in the country and the world sees it as the establishing shot. That's how you know where you are, this great big orange bridge. But when you sort of go across it a couple times a month and you walk across it and you run across it and you go to the park and there it is, and it's just a really amazing piece of Art Deco era art that stands there in this amazing setting. And I thought, I can't write another book about San Francisco without making the bridge part of it. So that was my motivation in the first place.
Okay.
And the way I worked it into the book is to say, well, these ghosts are souls that are caught between two worlds. And a bridge is a place between two places, especially a big bridge like the Golden Gate Bridge. So that's how I brought the bridge into it, was to make it a place where the ghosts sort of inhabited, because it was a place between two places.
Now, in Secondhand Souls, you put together a pretty motley crew. Will you tell us a little bit about who they are and some of their roles?
Sure. Charlie Asher is in the first book. He was a beta male who gets the job of being deaf and runs it out of the secondhand store. But he ends up, by the end of the book, being trapped in sort of this little 14-inch tall meat puppet. And I thought, well, I got to get him out of there. So a lot of the book is concerned with getting this single father, beta male guy back into a human body by his Buddhist nun girlfriend. Yeah, it gets weird. And Audrey is a Buddhist nun who found the missing books of the Tibetan Book of the Dead when she was studying to be a monk. And so she is able to transfer souls with these different rituals, because the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, they believe there's a 49-day period called bardo between life and death, where there's actual a ritual is required for a soul to move on, and the monks perform this. So we have Audrey, who's a sort of goofy ex-nun, and Charlie Asher and his little daughter Sophie, who may be the big death, the Grim Reaper we've all come to know, except she's a 7-year-old little girl and is sort of playing with the four little ponies of the apocalypse.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to little Sophie in a bit.
Yeah. One of my favorite characters, and one that I get asked for all the time, is this 7-foot African-American guy named Minty Fresh, who owns a used jazz record store in the Haight. He sort of inhabits a lot of my books, actually, and I always get more requests for him. There's a guy who we don't know who he is, who's sort of maybe a bad guy, who's dressed all in yellow, and I, for most of the book, just call him the Yellow Fellow.
Oh, wow.
That's revealed at some point later on in the book. Let me see, you've got a couple of homicide cops. One of them's gay because it's San Francisco, and you got to
represent.
Got to represent, thank you. And there's Lily, who's this goth girl who works in Charlie's shop, and she's always wanted something really dark and spooky to happen to her, and she's completely frustrated with the fact that all this dark and spooky stuff is happening to all these nerds that she knows, And she, who is completely qualified by having thought about it her whole life, it can't have anything special and spooky happening to her. And then one of the main characters of this book is Mike Sullivan, who paints the Golden Gate Bridge. And,
wow.
You know, he does it 300 days a year, and he's up 600 feet above the water painting the bridge orange when one of the ghosts of the bridge says, hey, could we get a little help over here? And the story sort of takes off from there. Those are pretty much the main characters.
Now, the reason why I kind of cut you short a little bit with Sophie is because I wanted to ask you particularly, what's up with little Sophie, and what is she babbling about?
Sophie was born of strange circumstances, and we are led to believe that she is what they call the Luminatus, the representative of the forces of light, and puts order over life and death that allows everything to sort of work. And the forces of chaos or dark are trying to manifest themselves. But she's a little girl. She's not particularly good at it. And yet she knows by the time the second book starts, by the time Secondhand Soul starts, she knows she's death. She knows this is her thing. So she picks up a lot of foul-mouthed language from her auntie, who's been raising her since her daddy, she thinks, has passed away.
Right.
And she sort of talks like you think a seven-year-old might talk if they thought they were an ultimate power in the world. So what it leads into is a lot of comedy of what this little kid saying things that are really unlikely for a little kid to say. And I have a little bit of fun with it. You know, most seven-year-olds, they don't say things like, I am become death, destroyer of worlds, you know, which is the quote from Oppenheimer when he created the atomic bomb. But Sophie is, you know, busts that out pretty quick. And she thinks that, you know, because she's a supernatural being, she feels there's a pretty good chance that other supernatural beings exist also. And so she's going to smack up the Tooth Fairy for not leaving her last quarter, you know. I think she says something like, I'm going to smack that bitch up and take her wow. bag of quarters, which, again, coming from a seven-year-old is not something that you expect.
Yeah.
But it's funny.
Yeah, and, you know, I remember Sophie on my playground when I was in elementary, but that's another story. How can our listeners find out more about your work, and where can they find you?
I'm out and about on social media. You can find me at chrismoore.com, not Christopher Moore, just because it was easier to type in. chrismoore.com. I'm on Twitter at The Author Guy, and that's The Author Guy, all one word. So you can yell at me personally there. And I'm on Facebook under Christopher Moore. And you can find the books at any bookseller, either online or your local independent bookstore. And they should be able, if they don't have it, they should be able to get it for you.
All right. And for our listeners, I recommend that you actually take some time and look. If you want to have some good laughs, go for it. Chris, which religions and folklore did you use to explain the metaphysics of the story, and why?
Metaphysics of it is sort of based in Buddhism because, you know, I think a lot of us, and I did, Westerners believe that the concept of karma is some sort of punishment.
Right.
And what in fact it is that eternal part of you is presented with lessons. And if you don't get that lesson, then you have to live another life until you do get it. So it's more like remedial fifth grade than it is purgatory. And so the way the souls transmigrate from one body to another is they're going on to learn a new lesson in this new body so that that eternal part of them can become an eternal part of the universe. Well, you know, in the Christian religion, that would be to go to heaven, but among the Buddhists, that is to become one with all things. They're not really incompatible with one another. It's just a way of looking at stuff.
Right.
But because of the sort of cheesy nature of putting human souls into objects, which I did just because of the ironic effect of it, the Buddhism worked the best. And because there were actual rituals in a certain sect of Buddhism where they move the soul from one body to another actively, or you could offer your body up to someone for a soul, I thought, well, that would be the perfect way to put the mechanics of a guy who's a hypochondriac getting the job of death, which was the sort of leading premise to both of these books. Now, what happens is, as the book goes on, is that you get these other points of view and other religions and their point of view of death, because it's always been ever-present in human thought. So you get Celtic death goddesses, Egyptian death gods who are trying to manifest, and in the first book, Greek death gods that are trying to manifest. And then Sophie is sort of at the middle, this little girl is at sort of the golden child, if you will, but she's not really particularly good at it. So, you know, maybe that's another book somewhere where she figures out what she's doing. But it draws most strongly on Buddhism, but it doesn't exclude other myths or faiths either, because since I started doing this job, I've always tried to explain to people that a myth is just a religion you don't believe in. And so I just try to treat each of them as stories and use the stories that accompany a religion as a means for telling my story.
Okay, so you're using things that we're familiar with and helping us to have a connection with your story.
Yeah, and sometimes revealing the, you know, and you brought up Lamb earlier, and a big purpose of sending Biff and Josh on their journey to the East was to show the similarity in Taoism and Buddhism and Christianity, and to saying, you know, you can find very often the Buddha saying almost exactly the same thing that Jesus said. And all the major faiths of that time had a concept of the golden rule. So, you know, it's more just trying to find the compatibility of what we all share as being human by how we manifest our faith.
What's next for you? I'm thinking maybe an ocean kayaking, scuba diving, photography novel?
I actually did one of those called Fluke and got to use all of those hobbies/skills. I'm going to do, I think, a noir-style mystery set in San Francisco in 1947. I'm mainly doing it because I like, you know, the tough guy mystery language.
Right.
I want to play with that a little bit. I do it a little bit in this book with one of the ghosts that's talking to the guy on the bridge. And I also want to write when there's no cell phones. It just is too convenient that everybody can know what's going on in every place. You know?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Chris. Your book, Secondhand Souls, it is humorous, and I really enjoyed, you know, being able to read it.
ChrisMoore.com for more on Chris, as well as his other books. You're listening to KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program, another author and another book just right for the season. It's Manuel Rogers in conversation with Begonia Echeverria, author of The Hammer of Witches, a historical novel set in a small Basque town filled with accusations of witchcraft.
You have written a book, The Hammer of Witches, but it didn't start off as a book. You started off doing research for music. In particular, will you tell us what type of music and why?
Sure, I'd love to. So I have sung my whole life Basque music. So I grew up in a Basque immigrant community in Chino. Basque people are often known as the people who sing. So I grew up singing it. My father's a singer. What I learned over time is that, like a lot of other traditions, the Basque country tradition of song is very male-dominated. So historically, there were actually laws passed against women singing certain genres of songs that they would be in charge of, like funeral dirges, for example. And a lot of the kinds of songs that were done in the Basque country took place in taverns or bars where it was unseemly for women to go. And so the song canon really is full primarily of songs that men have either written, or they're about men, or they're about male competitors in this ritual verbal dueling that's a big thing. And that experience of it being very male dominated was not one that I had as an immigrant's daughter. I hear it's sort of, you know, anybody can do it. But as I learned more about how in historically that it was male dominated, I became interested in singing songs that were, or finding songs that were written either by women, which they're very few and far between, or where the women were protagonists and not so much as objects of love or desire, which there's a lot of those. But in those songs, they're often talked about, but they don't talk themselves. So I have a group called Noka, and my other members are Kathy Petersons and Andrea Bedart. And we made a point of either finding songs that are from the perspective of women in Basque culture, or we write our own songs in Basque from either explaining our own perspective or talking about historical figures that involve female protagonists.
Now, the Basque people, where are they from?
Well, they're located in 7 provinces, and 4 of them are in Spain, in the north of Spain, and 3 of them are in the south of France. So they don't have a state on their own.
Right.
And so there's a French side and there's a Spanish side, or there's a northern side and a southern side. So it's the Pyrenees Mountains and along the Bay of Biscay.
As far as your research goes, how are the people today compared with the way they were as far as industry? You know, how they survive. What do they do? Are they still farmers and sailors?
Yeah, there's farmers and sailors, and also industry has been big. So historically, at least on the Spanish side, the 2 parts of Spain that were the most successful, the most economically successful, were Catalonia and the Basque Country, in particular, the area around Bilbao. Mm-hmm. So the turn of the last century, there was a lot of iron ore, and so there were a lot of big factories. So there's a lot of really booming industry because of the factories. But the people that my people come from are more inland. So we're either in the mountains as farmers, and there's really family farms, or along the sea, and they were sailors. So we have a lot of Basques who've gone around the world and tended to be the sailors or the farmers. And in the case in Chino in the Southern California, it was primarily men who came from farms who came here to be shepherds.
Wow.
That's kind of how they got here. So my father, for example, was a shepherd on Irvine Ranch, which I think it's hilarious. So a lot of the men who are in Southern California or in the Southwest, that's how their first in was to become a shepherd, and then most of them then went on to other industries.
Oh, so that's why we have the Basque in Nevada. They talk a lot about industry and shepherding, only to find out there's no grass.
So there was what happened was that like a lot of immigrant groups, they had large families. The oldest child would get the farmhouse, so everybody else had to find some other way of making a living, and sometimes that meant they married the heir of the farm next door. But in a lot of cases, when families were very large and when the economies were weak, there weren't other kinds of jobs for them to do. And so an opportunity was for them to come to America. And so for a lot of people who came here, that was a big opportunity for them to come. I mean, the living was better here as a shepherd even, because they would save their money and then be able to buy some land than for them to stay where they were.
Oh, okay. Okay, before we get too far into this, I would like for our listeners to know a little bit about you. As you said, you grew up in Chino.
Yes.
And it was a very tight-knit community.
Yes.
So what are some of the fondest memories you have about growing up in that tight-knit community here in Chino?
Thanks for asking. My main memories of the Chino Basque community was, as a girl, I was a part of a Basque dance group. So from the ages of 6 to 17, when I went away to college, I was in a Basque dance group, and we would have performances in the summer. We have in Chino and other communities throughout California, there are festivals, or we call them picnics, but they're bigger than picnics.
Right.
And we would perform at the picnics in the summer. It's become subsequently much more of a year-round activity. But when I was a girl, it was just during the summer. Then we would have Basque masses for Christmas time and Easter, and unfortunately a lot of funerals, but also some weddings and first communion. Like, I did my first communion in Basque. But the main thing that I did that was very Basque was that there were four Echeverria brothers that all came here. So on Sundays, we would go visit with each other. The main part that I really liked was visiting with my cousins on Sundays.
So you had a lot of family.
A lot of family.
A lot of friends.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Everybody could speak.
Not everybody could speak the language, but probably I would say out of every three people, perhaps one in my generation that was born here speaks Basque. So we just kind of similar to the percentage over there, interestingly, in certain parts. So my family comes from very close to the French border in the Bastan Valley in the mountains, and that's like always been like 98% Basque speaking. So that's where my family was from. So that was, my parents, that was their best language together. It was the best language of my aunts and my uncles together. So there were families like mine where that was the case, where both of the husband and the wife spoke Basque, and that was their best language, and they passed it on to their kids. But very often, like other immigrant groups, the men would marry a woman who was not Basque speaking, and then that here often it would be a woman from Mexico in some cases, because were from the Spanish side. So in that case, it was difficult to pass on the language.
Wow.
Yeah.
You work, with UC Riverside.
Yes.
I want to ask you, what is your association and your role with the UC Riverside and as an associate professor in California?
Yes. So I'm an associate professor at the Graduate School of Education at UC Riverside. And I've been very lucky that I've been able to pursue research that's in my area. So I'm a sociologist of language. All of my research is either ethnographic or archival, and it's all on Basque. But in general terms, it really speaks to the connections between language and culture and identity, different kinds of identity, either gender identity, national identity, religious identity. And so the courses that I teach are about those general topics, mm-hmm. where my research informs those topics, but I normally don't have much of an opportunity to assign my own work on Basque, but I am able to speak to research and use theories that speak to those issues in more general terms, for example, with regard to ethnic and linguistic minorities in California.
Oh, okay. Before you became the associate professor, you did a thesis.
My dissertation, yes.
Your dissertation. And it was on the music?
The dissertation was actually called Basque Schooling, What Is It Good For? Like that song. Well, kind of like a song.
Okay.
And so my dissertation was, I conducted it in the Basque Country in a city called Donostia or San Sebastian, where I looked at attempts to revitalize the language. Mm. And so I did some work in high schools there where I observed the use of Basque versus Spanish in schools where Spanish was the medium of instruction and where Basque was the medium of instruction. But subsequently, I've been doing a lot of archival research, and a lot of that has been on song. So, for example, I have a huge corpus of Basque song. I've probably looked at 5,000 songs altogether.
Wow.
I'm not using all of them, but so I look through that corpus in particular for songs, again, that are that relate to gender or identity. And some of those songs, then I sing with my group, and sometimes they inspire us to write our own lyrics. But I have written a couple of publications that relate specifically to Bass song as it relates to gender. And one of the latest, I think it is my latest publication, really looks at the representation of Basque witches in song.
Now, I have a copy of the CD, Noka 2. Thank you. A
lovely cover. Glad you like it.
It is a nice. I listened to it over and over again.
Thanks. Great.
And I have to tell you, let's see, one of my favorites was the first one. Now, let's see if I'm going to pronounce this right. Neska Saldana.
Close.
Saldua.
It's Neska Soldadua, which is the girl soldier. Yeah.
As you spoke earlier, you spoke about these being gender specific. This has more to do with women.
Yes.
So there are songs here, The Bickering Couple.
Yes.
A Lullaby for, what is that?
Mayelin is Kathy, one of the members of the group who helped to design the CD. She has two daughters, and Mayelin is the name of her older daughter. So one of the songs she sings to her because she was a baby at the time we were recording the CD.
Now, most of these songs are pretty lively. Mm-hmm. Some of them are a little bit quieter, but they all draw you in.
Oh, that's good to hear.
As I shared with you earlier, there was a time when I thought, I think I understand what they're saying, mm-hmm. and I didn't. But it drew me in just that much.
That's good.
You have Witch's Waltz.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that one because as you were doing your dissertation, and you moved more toward the music.
Yes.
There's something about witches and this music that you spoke of in your book. Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit with us why witches?
Well, as I was looking at this corpus of 5,000 songs and trying to find where are the female characters in the corpus, very often the topic, and in some cases the protagonists of the songs, they're witches. So there is a long tradition, a folkloric tradition in the Basque culture of witches and other kind of female characters. And there are some who argue that before Basques were Christianized, that it was a matriarchal religion. And so we have a lot of legends that have these very powerful female personages. So there were just a lot of them. There were just a lot of songs that had witches in them. And we've seen a couple of them in this CD and then a previous CD, and we have enough songs to have maybe one CD that's all witches, all witches all the time. And what was striking about that was that the version of witchcraft that I grew up hearing in these songs or hearing in stories, in particular when I was in the Basque Country, they're fun-loving tricksters. I mean, they may drink a little bit too much. In some cases, they'll crawl in through a keyhole and steal the boss's wine when he's out of town. And there's several stories, not so much in the songs, but in the legends where these other kinds of figures called lamignac or sirens, and they'll come down the chimney and they'll pester the housewife when she's spinning. So her husband's in bed already and she's spinning something, and you know, pester the housewife for soup and over and over again. And they have to trick the siren to go away and all that. So that's a kind of witchy activity that we see in song. And I was struck by how different that was from the kinds of witchcraft that the witches, in quotations, were falsely accused of practicing in the historical case.
Right. It's pretty amazing stuff. If you've ever listened or heard anything about the Salem witch trials, you'll understand a little bit about what was being spoken today. The mob mentality was pretty much the same.
Right, yeah.
Now, will you tell us, as the music got your attention, you learned more things about your own history.
Yes.
And particularly what was going on in the late 1500s and early 1600s, the trials that started up in Spain.
Yeah.
Will you tell us a little bit what you learned about that?
Sure. So the novel is loosely based on a historical witch persecution that occurred on November 8, 1610. It was the day that the witches, again in quotations, were burned. And it went very quickly. And what the evidence suggests was that, so at this time you have, again, the Basques are right on the border between Spain and France, and so you have a lot of religious conflict on the border, and you have Roman Catholics trying to root out the heretics and, you know, quotations, you know, the people who, anyone who's not Catholic, and so Protestants and witches and, you know, Jews and Moors, they were called the Moors, and Protestants are doing the same thing. So it's right on the border. So in 1609, there was a witch persecution on the French side to root out heretics. So they were interested in Protestants, but also in witches. And so there was a investigator who captured 80 witches and burned them at the stake on the French side. And around that same time, there was a young Basque woman from the Spanish side who came home telling all these tales about she was a witch and she did this and she done that. All this stuff started happening. And so the parish priest was very concerned that, you know, this is going to go to stop it. And so he arranged to have this girl and others who had also started saying that they were witches to make a public confession, to sort of calm it down, like, well, you'll make a public confession, you know, I'll forgive you, you'll promise never to be a witch again, and everything will go away. So they did that. So he was really trying to make it calm down. And there were some witnesses to their testimony who thought, well, they got off too easy. So one of them told the Inquisition that there are these witches going on over here, and they're not letting them go. And the evidence suggests that there was a social climbing priest that did that, that sort of told on them.
Right.
And then the Inquisition came in, and then once that started its machinery, then it was pretty much impossible to stop.
I'd like to know what life was like for those people before the witch trials. What was their daily lives like?
Well, the region where the Bastan Valley, again, which is where my family is from, the two towns there, Sugaramurli, try saying that three times fast, and Urvasubi. But I just call it the Bastan Valley. And so the town that I have this take place in the novel is a pseudonym, but it's based on those towns. And the pseudonym is Indatse, which means to strengthen, because it's a word in Basque, which means Indara. And still farming communities, very small communities. For the most part, they wouldn't have been literate, except for the monks and priests who would have had the opportunity to learn not only Spanish, but probably could read and write in Basque and Latin. But very rural, very small communities, and beautiful. So if any of your, I'm sure many of your listeners have been to the Basque Country, and it's very pretty even now. So it's very, you know, hilly and green and beautiful farmhouses. And so it's really shocking to think about what happened there, because everybody was related, you know, or neighbors, at least neighbors are, if not, also related. And so that's what's shocking about it, looking at the history, is at least I like to imagine myself that I wouldn't have brought up my friends or gotten my family members into trouble. But in the end, there were really no strangers that they were accusing. It would have been someone that they knew.
And that right there is amazing in itself, because these were basically people that they had their everyday problems, like every society.
Sure, yeah.
But they weren't running around trying to kill each other because of foolish things like your a witch, you're a warlock, you like Spain, you like France.
Right. Well, they would have been the same. They would all have been Basque-speaking Roman Catholics, all of them. And so what's surprising and unfortunate is how easy it was to rile them up to making these false accusations. So the people who were accusing themselves or others, they knew they were making false accusations. I mean, there was no evidence anything that was going on that they were accused of, but they had no choice, because the Inquisition would not tell them who was accusing them of witchcraft. So they would say, Begonia, just give it up, because we know you're a witch, we have witnesses, of course we can't tell you their names, you know, protect them. But if you admit to it and say you're sorry, make a confession, we'll leave you alone. So after we take your property and, you know, maybe you spend some time in prison, and they would have these penitential garments called sanbenitos, which I describe in the novel. They would put the name of the person, and they'd have figures showing what their crime was. And so if you were forgiven, you would have a St. Andrew's cross in the front to show that eventually it would be back in the good graces of the church.
Wow.
So you would be asked to wear this in your village. If you burned the stake as a heretic, they would take the sanbenito and they would hang it in your parish church so people would know, oh, Begonia, she was a witch. She died on this day. And when it got bad, they would make a new one.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it was 100 years after somebody had been condemned as a witch or whatever other kind of heretic you were burned as. In this case, it was witches. But it was either that or insist on your innocence and risk being burned at the stake.
Right.
So the easier choice for most people was, okay, I'll make the false confession, pay my penalty, and then I'll go back to normal and hope that my friends know, and my family knows that I'm really not a witch. But it was a really difficult choice.
Now, we know that, at least from your book,
right,
Spain played a large role. A lot of the things your people learned actually came from Spain before they started accusing each other.
Mm-hmm. What
role did Spain actually play?
Well, I think that it's important to talk about the apparatus of the Spanish Inquisition. So essentially what you have is, like all communities, like all people, I mean, we have our good sides and our bad sides. So it wasn't that Basques were better than other people in terms of never thinking ill of their neighbors or calling people words that I can't pronounce on the radio. But what happened in this case was that once the Inquisition's version of witchcraft came into play, and they would ask these very leading questions in Spanish, and the people who didn't know Spanish, except for the priests and the monks, so they would have a translator. But I've looked, and I haven't been able to find the actual transcripts of the interview. So we all know what it's like to play telephone, or, you know, feel like, well, I said this and it wasn't translated exactly the way I meant. So it's hard to know if how fair that was to the accused to have a translator. So the Inquisition would come in with its procedures and its questions, very leading questions. It was very clear what they wanted you to say.
Right.
Because it only helped the Inquisition, at least the higher ups, to be able to say, look, we found this heretical cult and we stamped them out. And again, once it started, it was just difficult to stop. In this historic case, once you had some people saying that they were witches, they said, well, right, see, it exists. It didn't matter that they later tried to recant their accusations. So in the historical case, a lot of those who made false confessions actually went to the Inquisition. They walked over 100 miles to try to say, look, we lied. They coerced us. They threatened us. They told us we needed to do this or they would kill us. And they, oh, no, the devil got into you and now you're refusing to admit the truth. So there was just really no way out once the apparatus of the Inquisition came into play.
You had two different cultures, actually, with the Spanish and the Basque, and the Spanish being primarily in charge of these trials?
Yeah, so you would have Basques were practicing Catholics, but they would not have been involved in the higher-up positions in the Spanish Inquisition, so the inquisitors and those, the higher-ups who were making, they were taking their cues from Rome.
So did they actually come to the Basque country and reside over these?
It happened in Spain. So the Roman Inquisition would have tribunals all over Catholic countries. So they had them in Mexico and even places very far afield because of colonization. And so each country would have its own set of tribunals that were in charge of the region. And so Logroño, which is in the Rioja province of Spain, so it's the wine country, was that tribunal was in charge of all of the Basque region. So they would have all the Inquisition personnel would be based there. And if there were accusations of some kind of heretical activity made to them, and there was enough credible evidence, they would go in and investigate. And it was a big thing. I mean, they would have a procession and, you know, on horses and, you know,
wow.
All kinds of
parade.
Pretty much a parade, these are very small towns even now. So you can imagine being this farmer and you're working in the field and here's this procession of people with fancy horses and, you know, the banners and all of that that the Inquisition would come in with. So they would come in and they would interview people who either were themselves saying they were witches or were accusing someone else of being a witch, and they would have somebody write down all the testimony, and then they would then talk to the person who was being accused of witchcraft in this case, not tell them who told on them, but they would ask them to respond to the allegations, and they would have their own set questions to find out. So if they did, for example, in some cases they were admitting to be witches, they would try to determine if they were dreaming or not, and if they felt they really were flying to the Sabbaths, you know, actually doing it or just dreaming it and all that. But there was a whole process. And Basques were involved to the extent that Basques, since Christianization, have been very much involved in the clergy. But the Inquisition itself was not indigenous to the Basque country. It was like anything else where some people would then be in positions where they would either have some kind of role in it, but they were certainly not in charge.
Wow, that sounds like a really dark, really ethereal type of horrible carnival with the parade. And
yeah, it's interesting that you should say carnival, because another interesting part of this whole story is that we talked about how you had this very small community going mob mentality. But part of it, what's interesting, is most of the accusations were made by children. So it sort of upended the hierarchy of the church, where these kids would, you know, have these inquisitors just listening to them rapt, like, wow, then what happened when the witch took you to the coven? And so there was a lot of that carnival aspect in terms of turning around the church's practices or hierarchy or who is it that has knowledge. And the other thing that is very carnivalesque is in terms of the violence. So there's a lot of violence almost that you'll see sometimes in terms of play acting that you'll see sort of in carnival times, but it was real. So you would have, in some cases, people who had accused someone of being a witch and they weren't going to wait for the Inquisition to do their investigation. Instead, they would punish the witch themselves. A lot of the elements of that is very ritualistic in the sense of a carnival in terms
right.
of what they would do to the victim and then how they would parade them around the town. And so.
Now, before I ask you about some of the characters and what's going on in the book, I'd like to ask you about a name that shows up in every chapter at the beginning.
Yeah.
Please tell us about the Malleus.
It's the Malleus Maleficarum, and it's actually a text. It's a Latin text, and it was written in 1468, I believe, by a Dominican priest. So he was a Roman Catholic German priest. And it's essentially a handbook for finding witches.
So, really?
Yeah, 1468. So it was three volumes, and it would have all these questions. Essentially, how do you root out a witch? It's terrible, the things that it says. And it's a very misogynist text, very misogynistic.
Yes, it is.
And what I went through the whole thing, and I picked passages from the Malleus that illustrated what that chapter was about.
Okay.
To kind of frame sort of the negative view of women rampant in Europe at the time. So these ideas about witches, they were part of a larger picture of seeing women as being very evil and all of that. And there's a poem that I contrast with Amalius in the novel that was written in 1545 by a French Basque priest. And some of it's very doctrinal kinds of poetry or devotional kinds of poetry, but he also has some love poetry. So his poetry at that time had a very different view of women, which was very positive. So you have kind of both, but certainly for this time, a lot of religious theologies had very negative views of women.
Right.
And so I thought it was important to show that, but also to show that one of the first characters that we meet in the novel, one I know is your favorite, is a woman who also ascribes to this view, or at least pretends to, because it helps her out. So I tried in the novel also to have both, you know, men and women who kind of ascribe to both views of women, both as women as being evil and both the women as being good and everything in between, because I think it's sort of an unfair characterization to say only men thought that.
And this is Salvador's mother, one of the main characters in the book. She doesn't have a name, first name. But
I did that on purpose.
But we, anyone who has read the book and anyone who will read the book will call her many names.
Yes. That's one way to put it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I didn't do it out loud, but a lot of names came to mind.
It rhymes with which.
Okay, so will you tell us a little bit about some of the characters here? Let's start with Salvador. And move on down, because Salvador and Dolores, that really bothered me right off. I mean, you start off and it's like, oh, this is nice. And before I finish page two or three, wow, I hate Salvador's mother.
Yeah. So his name is Salvador Zabaleta, and Salvador in Spanish means savior. Mm-hmm. And Zabaleta is a Basque word that means to expand or distribute. So I try to be very specific with the name so they would kind of forecast what the character would do. And Dolores means sorrows. There's a Basque version of that as well, Nekane. So I knew right away that things were not going to go well with them. But so what happens with Father Zabaleta is when he's a young man, he just falls head over heels in love with Dolores, and he's just very happy, and they're going to get married, and he's going to tell his mother this wonderful news, and right away, and this is not too much of a spoiler alert, the mother essentially blackmails Salvador to become a priest, because by doing that, then she gets status because now she's the mother of a priest.
Right.
And so Dolores, things do not go well for her after that. So he's my long-suffering character.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
And there's that power play again.
Sure.
His mother has her position in the church, and though she's still a woman, she held some power because of what she can go out and accuse others of.
Yeah, and even now, at least until relatively recently, I mean, it has been a very prestigious thing to have a priest in your family.
And there is Maria.
Yeah. And so Maria is 15 years old, and when we open to her first scene, she's very happy because she's turned 15.
Right.
And she's taking a long time to come home. She's going to the well. And
she's
going to
learn how to read.
She's going to learn how to read. Yeah. She's really excited. That was her mother's present to her to arrange for somebody to come to teach her, which would have been very unusual at that time for anybody, but certainly a girl.
Right.
And her mother, Dolores, dies under suspicious circumstances, and so her life pretty much, as she had imagined it, is over.
Right.
And she is, of course, she's 15. She's devastated because she just lost her mother, so she's young. But then she already has to take on these very adult responsibilities on the farm, and it's just, this is not the life that I wanted. This is not the life my mother wanted for me. So she's pretty devastated. So her character has to struggle with that, like the sense of family responsibility to her father and her brother, who's much younger,
right,
and trying to be a good daughter, but also trying to stand up for herself.
Tell us a little bit about Sabine.
So Sabine Elizalde, her last name means on the side of the church in Basque. She is this redheaded stranger that comes in out of nowhere.
Right.
And so it takes us a while to figure out what she's doing there. But soon after she arrives, Father Zabaleta, who at that point is the parish priest of the town that he'd left, is informed by the Inquisition that there's been rumors of this redheaded witch that's, you know, escaped from the French side and now is living on the Spanish side, and would you please check that out? And then he's afraid that the witch persecutions are going to start all over again. So he's trying to protect both Sabine and, but in particular, Maria from the witch persecutions.
Now we have Sabine. Maria was promised by her mother that she was going to send Maria to Sabine so Sabine can teach her to read.
Right.
She is really more than a stranger in this book because she is a strange character.
Mm.
She is a strong woman.
Yes.
in this time period.
Right.
That speaks her mind.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
She was easy to write.
Yeah. You would think that that would have gotten her a trip to the stakes
yeah.
and things.
Yeah. And that was more likely to happen. It was difficult to be anyone of a certain class who had a strong opinion that was against whatever the orthodoxy was of the time.
Right.
But particularly if you were a woman. So she was very loosely based on a wealthy widow who was also accused of being a witch. And she was able to use her wealth to bribe people, et cetera. So some of that I do in the novel. But there were some women in particular, if they had the opportunity to become educated, who they had the means, both intellectual and material, to take a stand. So I needed a character like her because I needed somebody to do the things that she ends up doing. And it couldn't be Maria. I mean, I think maybe as contemporary readers, maybe we want Maria to do certain things, but she couldn't have as a 15-year-old peasant in that time period. So I was in a writing group and I'd want these things to happen, but you know, I needed a character that I hadn't created yet to do it. And so that's kind of how she came into being.
Okay. Now see, this is amazing again, because one of the characters in the book accuses Maria.
Yeah.
But he himself was not really a believer mm-hmm. as he was purported to be.
Right.
So what we have, people that are not looking so much to do what their religion says, but trying to get power for their religion at the same time.
Yeah. So that character is named Feliz Sigor. So Feliz.
We don't like him either.
We don't like him either. Yeah. But his name, it means happy punisher.
Okay.
Because Sigor in Basque means to punish and Feliz in Spanish. And he also was a character that I was encouraged to conjure up by my writing group because I needed somebody to do these terrible things.
Right.
So he's sort of a composite of many players who maybe in their hearts they thought they were believers. I mean, they, you know, we certainly have
yes.
people who think, oh, this is really, really I believe. And I really believe what I should be doing is getting rid of everybody else.
Yes,
but in this case, it's very clear that he's a social climber and he's using the Inquisition as a way of getting his own power and increasing his own status. But I did need him to be sort of the one kind of focal representation of that kind of person at that time.
Of which there were many.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Okay, and how can they get a copy of the book, The Hammer of Witches?
It's on Amazon, and it's not the only Hammer of Witches, so you have to put in my name as well. But it's also in the UCR bookstore, and it's at Romans in Pasadena.
Manuel Rogers in conversation with Begoña Echeverría, author of The Hammer of Witches. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Begoña Echeverría and to Chris Moore. Again, Chris's latest novel is Secondhand Souls. ChrisMoore.com for more. Here at KVCR, thanks to Emmanuel Rogers, Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Weisgarver, Sean Hulan, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear many past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.